Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your co-host, Chris Seveny. Lauren did not join us today. She's got other arrangements she's dealing with, but we have a special guest today. We have Charles Gao of Twin Oaks Capital. Charles, how are you today?
Doing all right, thank you.
Today, we are going to start on talking about quality over quantity. And is it actually better? Should you go after quality or should you go after the numbers? I know a lot of people can argue both sides of that coin. Today, we'll talk about with Charles and his philosophies in investing and especially the different strategies he has. As similar to myself, Charles invests in multiple classes of real estate. Interested to see where this will go. Charles, why don't you start by telling us, what are you doing today? What's your company profile look like?
Our investment portfolio, as far as the operating side or assets under management, is self-storage, multifamily, industrial, and mobile home parks. And then I also have service-related businesses or equity shares in that. And then it's even more diversified when you get into my passive investments or things I'm investing with a note or as a syndication or whatnot. And that extends into assisted living facilities. I'm trying to think. Service businesses, car washes, office, you name it, we've across the board.
Okay. What do you like the best? If you could choose only one, which one would it be?
I'm not a person that invests for class. I'm a person that invests for opportunity. For me, I'll use Dallas example, but if you could have gotten to any asset class in Dallas in the right neighborhood 10 years ago, there's no way you could have lost money because the population and some counties around there, over 10, 15, 20%. I am a person that invests primarily in areas that have very strong economic factors, primarily strong population growth, particularly in the younger populations between 20 and 40, which will also have kids increase the population further, and also with strong job diversity growth too as well. Healthcare, military, technology, those three sectors I look for a lot of growth in because those generally drive a lot of strong economic factors. People ask me all the time, you know, that question, they're surprised I don't see self-storage because that's what I've been doing a lot of lately. Really just more about the economic factors of the area and the individual deal itself. I can't say there's one asset class I specifically like more than the best because you can quickly change my mind with a big checkbook or bank account balance for one asset.
Interesting that you've been gotten to where you've gotten today. Now, funding your deals, are you typically doing this like a Regulation D 506C or your own personal money? How do you typically fund your deals?
Have not done a 506D yet. I do like a combination of both. So I've done 506B. We've done notes where our entire debt structures. I've done investments with family and friends. I've done it with just primarily my own funds. I've also done it primarily bank funds as well. It's just a combination. Sometimes I have investments that I really like, but on paper, they may not look good or be as easy to pitch to an investor. Whereas I have other ones that are very easy to pitch to an investor that I actually may not be as high on because I might notice some other factors that a desktop computer may not notice. Ultimately, you know, one of the things I like about real estate is there's so much diversity. Even within the assisted living asset classes, there's even five subclasses of that. I do like variety because for me at this time, I do real estate more because I like the challenge more so because of the money.
How'd you get into real estate in your real estate career?
Yeah, so I didn't really have a choice. I was enslaved into real estate by my dad. He pretty much tied myself to a tree with a chainsaw to take a tree down, flat roofing a commercial restaurant. You name it, I pretty much did it. And if it could be done for more than $50 by unskilled labor, my dad could do it with me for free. It pretty much was done by me. So my dad was an immigrant. He moved to the United States, couldn't speak English very well. And he got a job with a woman as a handyman. And then over the course of the next 20 years, he created so much value for her that she eventually sold her off her entire commercial real estate portfolio to him. And as that happened, my dad still managed that portfolio, still did his full-time job. And I was the full guy to utilize my kids wherever I can to help me with the business. From translating legal documents, you know, when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, I had a lot of exposure to all types of real estate. And we were super hands-on, which that was actually one of the reasons why I got out of real estate. Cause I was like, real estate sucks. This lifting toilet, dealing with tenants, like giving you excuses for why they can't pay. But then you see them like come home with a brand new Mercedes, all that kind of stuff I dealt with. And I basically got out of real estate altogether for 10 years because I just felt that I don't want to work that hard. But the truth was, is that it was ingrained in me to work hard. I worked in corporate America, worked at some of the largest companies in the entire world, or even the largest in their sector in the entire world. And I realized that if I'm making them $80, $90, $100 million a year from sales, pretty confident I could do this for myself and maybe not work as hard as my dad did. And so that's how I got back into real estate.
Yeah, you realize that you're still going to work just as hard because it's ingrained in you. You're just doing it for somebody else and you're letting them reap the rewards or the profits from it compared to doing it on yourself. No, that's awesome. So we started off a little bit talking about quality over quantity type deals and stuff. And you want to share what shifted your mentality? Because I know some investors would rather just have, hey, I want to go have 500 doors or I want to just keep growing my portfolio and stuff. And they might be C-class or some others that really cause you to pull a lot of that hair out. Sounds like you like to keep a small staff focused on the right deal and one that's quality deal that is going to provide a nice return to you, your investors, family, or whoever's involved.
Yeah, I feel like I've learned this lesson multiple times in our business, but then at times I'm maybe this aspect of the business, that's not the way I go. But universally, I feel like throughout my life, of all our businesses, that's been the case. And I would say the first time I got that lesson was that I know you have your mortgage company and notes. What we were doing is we were dealing with a lot of investors on the brokerage side. And sometimes we would get them good deals where they were just too small for us. We didn't want to purchase it. So we were just like, let's just make a commission on it and then move this deal because we don't want to buy a fourplex. It's too small for us, but it's a great deal for our client. And then what would happen, we would find too as well, is that I'm like, wow, we got them such a good discount that we took advantage of this rule essentially where if you buy property cash, then when you go to refinance out, it's considered a cash out refinance, which means you have to do a lower LTV. And it's typically a higher rate because it's considered a riskier mortgage. But if I allow you to buy that property with my cash and do it as a note, now you're doing it as a rate and term refinance, you're getting a better rate and go higher LTV. And on top of that, it can be based off the appraised price, not based off of cash. You don't have that 6-month holding period. You would have a client that's, hey, you're going to buy this. Numbers weren't that good, but we definitely had some close, but we'll just use round numbers. You're buying this place for $200,000. It's going to appraise for $300,000. We're going to lend you the full $200,000. We're going to make a commission on it. And then on top of that, we're going to make $10,000 lending on it. And even though we're doing all this in 3 weeks, you don't care that I made $10,000 and lending on it in 3 weeks because you just got a property free and clear. Because when you refinance out, you're refinancing out for $200,000. So you just bought a property with no money down. When we were doing deals like that, I was like, wow, if we could just do more deals like this where we get the commission, we lend on it, we get a happy customer, and then not only on top of that, but because they didn't put $90,000 down or whatever they had to, now they're still got that $90,000 to buy even more with us. So I can work with fewer clients rather than let me get another client and let me get them up to speed. Let me teach them how to invest. Let me teach them how to underwrite. And so that's when we first got realized that we can work with fewer clients in a brokerage that really just basically serves them ultra well. One, they will sing our praises. Two, they may or may not refer us because some of them don't want it because they don't want us to lose their business elsewhere. But we just thought that was the best way to grow that business. And flash forward today, I was actually with two different private equity groups and I got single digit percentages of both groups. But one of the things that you noticed though, is that even though I was only working for equity, I was a partner. It was like 13, 14 calls. I had a business that my dad, that we had sold off. And I remember when we sold off the business, they wanted us to be part of the new company. And the new company was just calls and calls, training new people. It was just so much. And I realized, do I want 10% of a $100 million company or do I want 50% of a $20 million deal? And then that way I can just do 1/4 the amount of deals, run them super efficiently. And that way I don't have to worry about, okay, I got to manage this person. Oh, that person's person will quit. Okay, now I need you to do that job, but then I need to train you. Now I need to step in. So I'm doing all these additional tasks. And so that's why I just came to the conclusion, you know, I'm perfectly fine with doing 2 to 3 deals a year, 10 million plus deals, whatever, 5 million plus deals, having more equity in them. And then also I can be more efficient with them too as well. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm the only one doing it. I still have a decent staff. I got 2 VAs. I got a full-time assistant. I got another partner. My wife's active in the business. And then I even have key personnel insurance. So if something ever happened to me, my investors are covered with a life insurance policy. But ultimately, I just felt that was a better approach for my lifestyle, because for me, I didn't really care about whether I have 100 million or 2 million. All I care about is what actually goes in my pocket. But more importantly, how much work-life balance I have. Because on average, I would say I definitely work under 25 hours a week on the average week. Tax season's coming up. I might have to spend work a little more to get some stuff. But then I also work a lot of 5-hour weeks in there too as well.
So it's interesting. You brought up a point there that I just want listeners to hear about. And it's a very random one. But like you mentioned, the key person policy. We have those with our company as well. Life insurance policies where with our investors, something happens. There's insurance that covers significant portion of the replacement also. But if there was ever, it's a policy that's very good to have. The other thing that was interesting that I wrote down, very similar with our company where we try and focus or target on the right deals versus the number of assets. And people ask us, our company's on around $10 million right now, and we want to grow it to basically say $50 million by the end of the year. Oh, your staff is going to have to increase significantly. And I'm like, actually, no, we'll probably have to add like one additional person. And they're like, how's that the case? And I'm like, it's really in the note space, again, based on deal size. Right now, we have our average notes $100,000, all of a sudden our average note goes up to $250,000. We can still have the same number of notes, but we just 2.5x'd our numbers and still be able to manage. Because I'm the type of person, I think similar to like you, I don't want to manage 50 people. I've worked for companies that were that size, and you work for corporate too. And when you're doing that, a lot of times you're more of an HR manager more than anything.
That came up recently when we let go of one of our VAs. Actually, one other thing I wanted to time too, because you mentioned it too as well. But within our company, we have a metric. Actually, I've heard other people use it too as well, but we have a productivity per capita. But it's very common when you see these larger companies as they add employees on. So let's say a company's making $100 million. Well, let's just use round numbers. Let's say you have 10 people, and it covers $10 million. You would hope that if I added 11th person, we're going to go to 11 million or more, ideally, right? Oftentimes what happens is you add that 11th person and yes, your sales increases, but it might go to 10.5 million. So now your productivity per person has gone down. That's a metric that we focus on, as we've really focused on productivity per person. How can we make each person more productive, whether it's through incentives, whether it's through symptoms? And then if it is another person, and that person doesn't serve as sales without really drives, then what are they doing with the additional time that this person is going to save? So if I hire you a VA and you're doing sales, show me how is this going to be more sales for you? Because this person's a $40,000 salary or whatever, and I got to support this, then this is what we have to hit. So show me how you're going to get one more $1 million per capita out of this person through productivity, because they're obviously not going to be the one ringing phones. They're working as an admin role for you. That's a key metric that we work on too as well.
Yeah, that's great. I actually wrote that down. And we use something very similar, of course, on with our sales and marketing, whereas because we raise funds from investors, it's the cost per acquisition for a customer, if we spend $10 on marketing, did we get $100 off of it? And based on the different types of marketing you do, it's always analyzing the numbers of which one's providing the best results. And it might always not always be the one that has the highest ratio, because while the ratio might be high, the amount of dollars it's bringing in is significantly lower. And for you mentioned, if you're $10 million versus $20 million for us, if let's say after everything, we're making 5% on that deal, basically for doing the same amount of work, but just changing the portfolio structure, of course, we'd rather be at 20 than 10 with all things being equal. What's been your biggest challenge based on your business scaling and doing the different types of self-storage to pivoting to assisted living? What has been your biggest challenge?
It really depends on when you ask me, because I feel like every year the answer changes. So somebody's been hearing me from podcasts from a year ago. I'm not lying. It definitely has changed. I definitely think the most impactful thing in my life is that August, my dad let me know actually in July that August he was going to be moving in with us. And from that point when he moved into us, and then he's also moved to assisted living, And the care required to take care of elderly relative really forced me at times to step away from the business for a couple of weeks at a time. My wife was awesome that she really stepped up. In some cases, she might have been too helpful with my dad, but it really made me evaluate my business as a whole. And so one of the changes that came as a result of it was I do an exercise that is basically a rocks and pebbles exercise. Write down everything that basically you want to accomplish in your life right now. And then in the next 24 hours, which of these goals, if you accomplish the most, would impact it the most? I reversed it a little bit where then I took, okay, let's do all the tasks that I do. Okay, of all these tasks here, which ones do I absolutely have to keep? And then I also ordered them by of these tasks, which one makes me the most dollar per hour? And then I also try to figure in, is this something that I can maintain this dollar per hour if I work more hours, or is it something that I can make more per hour? So I prioritize it. And one of the conclusions was that essentially was that broker side of the business, while it is pretty good hourly pay, it is the worst return on time and is the worst one to compound for return on time, because if anything, my return time goes down. And then also on top of that, it's one time. There's no basically second investment. Whereas on the building construction management side, my return on time was, if not four figures per hour, it was probably closer to five figures per hour. To do that, I could do more of this and can I still get that? Yeah, probably pretty close. And then on top, I could get a little more efficient with it. I also potentially could train my staff to basically help me with it, where I'm training and I'm paying them $20, $30, $40 an hour to do a $10,000 task to potentially help me with. That's why we decided to pivot our model more towards that. And then also a little bit more towards consulting, whereas consulting is obviously returning time for money, but there are benefits to it. I learn about markets all over the country. And we've also been able to pivot that into partnerships too, whether it's raising capital for them, converting my consulting into equity, because they said, wow, you so much, we want you on this deal to help us run it too as well. So that was the lesson learned really that we got from that is that, and I recommend many people do that. Take 4 weeks away from your business and see what happens. It may really suck for 1 or 2 weeks coming back to that train wreck, but you'll really see where your deficiencies are in your business when you do that.
Yeah, I'm too much of a control freak. I couldn't do that. Back to that thing, and I enjoy hearing that story, and it gives shed because I unfortunately lost my father almost five years ago next month. And similar where I was working full time, but also had my side hustle. And that's when I had started getting involved in notes back in 2016 and early 2017. And I bought some assets, and then he'd been ill for a very long time, but just got even worse. And then it's interesting that when you reflect on things like it can really alter, change a course when you start looking at things in different perspectives. And I think it's good to look at things like that, because a lot of times we're so tunnel vision and focused on our business and put the blinders on and just are running. And especially I'm an engineer, so it's just like, how am I building the next step or the next piece? And sometimes it's good to have some of that outside interference. So I wanted to jump back about some of your deals. You sound might be buying some properties and stuff. Are you buying like distressed properties, rehabbing? Are you doing ground up construction? What have you been working on? Because if you start talking ground up, then I start smiling because that's one of my favorites.
Actually, when are we airing this podcast?
This will probably air in about a month's time.
Okay. All right. So that'll work then. So I am working on a large deal we will close on relatively soon. It was a portfolio of multifamilies I was helping asset manage.
Okay.
Essentially what happened was I provided so much value for the partners, and one of the partners was retiring and getting out. I was asked to basically buy into a portfolio, and I'm like, well, the portfolio is huge. I don't have those funds to get into it right now. And also I'm a little bit worried about bandwidth with the time. And the partners basically found a way for me to essentially buy in with no money down and also use my asset management fee to essentially serve as the monthly payment on the note. So I'll still get disbursements on it. And so I'm buying $10 million plus deal, actually well above that deal here very shortly with essentially no money down. That's what I'm working on right now. We had another very large 100 unit plus deal that we were working that fell through. And then I've been doing quite a bit of consulting. We had 3 new builds last year. Our primary lender that we're using essentially told us that we hit our exposure limit with them. So I'm trying to find another lender willing to take on that risk. And you could probably appreciate this, but what we decided to do with pivoting for our new construction is banks essentially were telling us, we do not like new construction at all, not right now. And also with these interest rates, it's pretty terrible. I know people always talk about skinning the game. Most of the investments I do with my investors, when it's all said and done, or right when we close, I typically have no money in the deal. But as most people know, that doesn't mean I don't have a ton of time and I have a lot of money invested in that getting reimbursed. What we're transitioning to now is that let's say a bank is going to say, let's say I do $1 million construction using round numbers.
Yep.
And they're going to say, hey, we'll give you 60 LTV. And mm-hmm. what typically happens then is that we close a loan, and then I have to put that $400,000 into the deal, which could take 4 to 6 months. Yep. And then they start lending me that $600,000 for the construction. Well, yeah, it sucks about that. Now I have this issue now where I wasted 6 months of my interest-only period where I wasn't even drawing from it. What mm-hmm. we're pivoting to is a model where now I front that. Let's assume that we are going to be 90% done with this construction, because we know that the day that we're finished building, you have equity and you actually have something that you can go after for collateral. It's tangible. But I want 75 LTV. They're like, yep, that's fine. So we will close this when I'm basically right about to finish the touches. So then what I do is I front that 25% down myself out of pocket. We close the loan where I basically am making that last contractor payment to fund it. And then my investors basically are getting in when we finish building. Reduces risk to the investor, reduces risk to the bank. And if the bank really comes back and says, we still don't like the deal because I just like to hold, then what I can do is say, I got this property free and clear. I got this other property lot of equity. Let me cross collateralize that as a down payment for 6 months until we stabilize. When you go back, somebody might say, you don't have any skin in the game. Technically, I did. I had 25% equity skin in the game for 6 months. That was all me. Then I'm also cross collateralizing another $1 million property on it too for 6 months. That's skin in the game. So I have money in the deal, but I definitely have skin in the game. So those are probably more recently what we're working on within our model.
Yeah, but I kind of want to rewind something a little bit there, because I know it sounds like the deal might not be finalized and stuff, but you're very nonchalant in the fact that you're getting equity into a deal. And again, you're not getting $10 million, but you're getting equity into a $10 million deal that basically is your investment is your asset management fee. So it's, you want to talk about learning or earn working as an sweat asset management equity, and getting exactly. You want to talk about sweat equity. Wow, that is amazing. I want to peel back a little bit and be like, how long have you been managing that asset for that investor? And how long have you had that relationship? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, I've always been a dog when it comes to work. Like early on to get experience, I knew that you need three things in real estate. And if you've heard me on any of my platforms, I say it all the time. You need time, capital, and knowledge, or you need access to those. You got to have at least one of them. And obviously, if you have all three, or you have a lot of one of those, then that helps. And so I had a lot of time at the beginning when I didn't have a lot of, use that time to gain knowledge. And then what happened is I would get to the point with self-storage facilities or multifamilies or whatever, where I could do this on my own. So then I would go to people, hey, let me manage your property for like 3% or 4%. And I would go in there, I'd do an absolutely amazing job for them. I crush it. And then after I crush for them, I'm like, listen, I've proved that I can basically do the deal for you. Now pay me market. They're like, no, I want to pay you market. I'm like, okay, cool. Then take it back. No, nope. They come back to me. Found ways to create value for myself by basically working for free or super, super cheap till I basically earn my keep where I could charge that. This model that I've kind of been doing, the reason why I talked about nonchalantly is because a lot of my deals that we did on the brokerage side, we would offer a lot of different structures. If somebody wanted to buy a $1 million deal from me, sometimes I'd be like, you know what? I really like this deal. I'll waive my 3%, 4%, 5% commission for 10 or 15% equity. What broker does that on a deal that's a dud? If I sell a deal to you that's garbage, why would I give up my commission, which is given to do it for equity? But I just thought all these different ways to try to create passive income for myself. And in this particular situation, what happened was the clients came to me about selling this portfolio. They gave me a number. That number's not possible. It's not going to happen, at least not with the way it is now. But I want the listing, and I know I'm competing with Colliers. I know I'm competing with CBR. I'm competing with some big brands that basically want that business. And on paper, they probably are more qualified. But what I can do that I know they can't do, well, actually, I don't want to say it that way, but just say that. Yeah. I feel like I offer a unique service they know is that let me make your property worth the $12 or $15 million or $16 million that you want. So essentially, I came back to them. I said, give me 4 units. Okay. I want these renovations done, and I believe we can get these rents. Once you get this portion of the portfolio done and leased out, now we've proven our concept to people. Now they know, wait, so if I put this $1 million and I can get this X back, now we have potential to get buyers because now we've shown partial proof of the concept. We haven't done it all the way. They're not going to pay all the pro forma, but now they will pay a portion of it because we put the model in place. They started doing that. But then when they did that, they're like, why are we going to sell to do this? Why don't we just keep it now? And so essentially I created the value for them and decided to keep it. all the other brokers were just trying to get money out of them. For me, I would basically was just trying to create so much value for them that like, hey, I'm your guy. Anytime you got $1 million listing, I'm your guy. And essentially what happened was I created so much value for them that they realized like, kind of like with one of my employees, if this guy keeps creating so much value for us, he's probably doing it for other people. If we don't bring him on to our company, we're probably not going to retain him. So that's essentially what they did. They said, we need to retain Charles as a partner so that way he still works with us because we need him unless we want to do it ourselves.
It's interesting because it makes me think, gives me a lot of like feeling with some of the things that I've done in the past. For example, when I got started, typical note investing where if you had an investor, you'd split the profits 50-50. They'd fund it. I started out basically, what is my competitive advantage? I don't have one, but all of a sudden it's like, I'm giving you more of that upfront profit. I'll give you 60, 70% upfront. Then people are like, whoa, wait a second here. Okay, let me try it. And then when they were, again, made them some serious money, they kept coming and then they kept telling somebody else. And then it's okay after one or two deals. Okay, now I do need market price and they'd still do better than probably others. And just thinking outside the box, that's what I really like about this, how you've basically took it upon yourself to really focus on being a differentiator and just being creative. And basically, a lot of people just want to follow the norms and just, okay, I'm just going to do everything the same. And when we created our latest fund, we basically did a lot of things different than other people. And there is education to educate people on some of these differences and make sure people understand it. But once you create that, you end up creating yourself that competitive advantage, which you've done, which then just generates some massive wealth opportunities for yourself. And the one thing I'll just mention is it doesn't happen overnight, people. It takes time. But if you stick with it over time, it can be extremely lucrative for people. As we wrap up this episode, I like to ask people as well if there's one tip, one nugget you'd like to leave people, as well as if a book you're reading right now or you read that really had some influence on you.
I read so many books, I get tidbits. I will say that to it's really rare to run up or read a book for me now that has just completely changes my life, unless it's like a spiritual or something like that.
Sure. They're all the same. Like I was reading Traction and then Scaled Up, which is basically very similar. Basically, the books are almost identical. They all have the same theories, which is work hard, people.
The last one that really had a ton of impact on my life, and it's an old book, but it's Brian Tracy's Maximum Achievement. And it's really about mindset and goal setting, that rocks exercise we talked about.
Yeah,
that was one. As far as for advice, the time, the knowledge, and the capital, I think that's, keep it simple. Those are the three things you need. But the other thing about it too as well is that I've made a lot of money being the bad guy. And when I say that, like I have a client, for example, that whenever he needs somebody to say no, oh, hey, would you consider investing $1 million into my new tech startup? They're like, oh yeah, sure. Let me refer you to my business partner, Charles, if he likes it. And really what they're doing is they're basically saying, hey, I need you to basically say no to this person. So
you're the bad cop.
Yeah, I do a ton of that for a lot of people. And that's why people dislike you because they're saying no a lot. Find a way to create value for others based on what their time is worth, not your time is worth. And quote my mentor, when I was texting him, hey, where can I look up rental certifications in Grand Rapids, things like that. He said you stopped ignoring them. And then I caught up with him like, hey, I've been trying to get a hold of you. What's going on? And really, I was kind of like, I feel like you're ignoring me. Yes, I'm ignoring you because you're asking me questions that you could find on Google in 2 hours or 3 hours or ask somebody else. But you're asking me because I'm making it too easy for you. So now I'm just politely ignoring you. And when I came to find out, I was, listen, your time is worth 30, 40 bucks an hour. I don't know what it is, but if my time is worth $10,000 an hour and your time is worth $30 an hour, if you can find something out in 3 hours, rather than asking me, have it take 10 minutes of my time, which costs thousands or hundreds of dollars an hour, you need to basically use your time to do that. Don't waste my time and act like it's worth what your time is. And to be honest, that's why it allowed me to pivot my bottle to create so much value for other people, which in turn made them want to work with me to the point also where now my time is getting to the point where it's worth so much that other people are trying to do the same with me as well. I would say today, over a dozen phone calls by 1 o'clock today from new investors asking me for help. And quite frankly, I ignored almost every single one of them because honestly, I was on computer or phone calls all day. That would be the biggest thing, is great value for somebody based on what their time is worth, not what your time is worth. And then you'll really understand like, whoa, if you just think about it, if I call this person up, is it worth asking this question if their time is worth $10,000 an hour? If you ask yourself, most time you will not pick up the phone and ask that person a question. You'll find somebody else, maybe their time is worth $80 an hour that can answer that question for you.
I am stealing that quote because I love that. And that's a great thought process for anybody to consider, especially people who are getting new into any type of business. Because we get been asked that similar questions a lot of times where I'll get some random email from somebody that literally it's something that can be looked up in a Google search where somebody will email me, hey, do I need to be licensed in this state? And it's like, Google it.
It's I can't very, find it. Well, yeah. Improve your Google skill set. So. Take a maybe, Google class. I don't care, but don't ask me.
I don't know. Maybe ChatGPT will be able to answer it for you coming up. Hey, Charles, thank you so much for coming on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. If people can create value and it's worth your time, what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
My YouTube channel, if people want to ask questions, most of the time when I post videos on that YouTube channel, it's because I have a question with the person. I'm like, you know what? Instead of just answering you, and because I know I'm going to get asked this, I'm just going to answer it so hundreds or thousands of people. So my YouTube channel at Twin Oaks Capital is the easiest way to really just learn. And then we go deep to how we cut concrete even. That would be the spot for that. And then Instagram is probably the next best spot. My name, Charles C-K-A-O at Instagram. That's probably the next best spot to see what we're up to and go from there.
Thank you again for joining us. And as always, make sure listeners to subscribe to us on your favorite listening channel. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.